like to open the Senate Education and General Government Committee. We are one down today because Senator Metzger has fallen ill. And I would like to open a public hearing on Senate Bill 375. Dana?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 375 expands upon current law that generally requires charter schools to demonstrate financial stability or soundness.
Good to have Senator Walker and Joe Crum.
Hello.
How are you?
Never right for me. I don't want to sit way over here. All right. Welcome. Glad to be here again. Senator Vicki Walker, District 7 of Eugene, and I'm here on Senate Bill 375, and I love this bill. This bill relates to the financial management of charter schools, and I have to tell you why I drafted it. There was a newspaper article that is in front of you that the North Clackamas School District was experiencing problems, and I'm so glad they're here today to discuss them. And so I read a lot, and I get a lot of my good ideas from the newspaper doing investigative stories, and I decided we needed some oversight on charter schools' financial management. So I had this bill drafted, and it really requires, as part of an applicant seeking a public charter school, that they will provide a description of the financial management systems for the public charter school and a plan for having the financial management systems in place at the time the school begins operating. I was actually thinking of adding a little bit more to that piece and designating what I wanted, like a chart of accounts, pro forma budget, those sorts of things. But there is a Department of Education, there's an ORS that directs the Department of Education to adopt uniform budgeting standards. So we can easily slip that in there, according to Hannah Y., the drafter that I spoke with again this morning. Why this is important is because I think it's important to not only know that the charter schools have the financial ability to exist, but I need to know and be assured that they are spending the money correctly. And they provide their audit now, but we need to provide all of their financial management information so that the school district, who's the sponsoring school district, can be assured that the taxpayer dollars being spent correctly. I also wanted to add a piece in here about requiring financial management education and training of all school board members, and I find it fascinating. Senator Morris, I know, was working on a bill, and you're looking at Senate Bill 903 in this committee about requiring that of regular school board members. I don't think it's a bad idea. Minnesota, from where I got a lot of my support for this bill, they're one of the biggest, well, they started out with the most charter schools in the country, I think. They did a review of their charter schools and realized they needed some more financial management support, and so they require within the first year a board member must get financial management training, and a regular school board member it's within the first 180 days. An additional piece that I think would be important to this bill would be to make sure that we prohibit a charter school sponsor from using a charter school relationship for financial gain. Statutes already impose such a prohibition on public individuals, but we have private charter schools that are sponsored by certain individuals, and they make a great deal of money at their endeavor. And I think that it's difficult when you have board members who are working to make money for the school. You might not get the kind of accounting that you're looking for. So that might be something we add. It's not in the bill currently. Let me direct you to ORS 327.511. That's the State Board of Education system that would require adopting a uniform system of accounts. So that's kind of really what I wanted here, is just to make sure that we have that financial reporting, that we have sound financial systems in place. Section 6 of the bill on page 5 says if you fail to maintain sound financial management systems for two consecutive years, you could lose your sponsorship. I do have in front of you, my staff gave to Ms. Richardson, a letter of support from the Portland Public Schools, as well as a letter of support from the Confederation of Oregon School Administrators. Their lobbyist was not able to be here today. I think he's in Pendleton. So that's really why I'm here. It's a pretty simple little bill. I love hearing it when someone says it's a simple little bill. It usually ends up being more complicated than that, but I think it is a simple little bill, and I'd like you to hear from Mr. Crum if you don't have any questions.
Okay, Mr. Crum.
Chair Haas, members of the committee, I'm here representing Superintendent Ron Naso, who couldn't be with us today, and I'm going to read his letter, which you should have copies of, or will have copies of. Chair Haas, members of the committee, thank you for the opportunity to present testimony in support of Senate Bill 375. I regret that I am unable to appear before this committee in person. However, a scheduling conflict has me attending an important meeting with my employee groups. The North Clackamas School District is the sponsor of record for 4 charter schools in our district. Till this past year, that number was 5. 2 of these charter schools, the Clackamas Webb Academy and the Clackamas Middle College, operate under the governance of the Clackamas Charter Alliance, which has its own board of directors. A third charter is an elementary school, the Cascade Heights Charter School, which also operates under its own board. The 4th is the Milwaukee Arts Academy, which operates in conjunction with our Milwaukee High School.
Mr. Crum, you don't need to read this whole letter.
Okay, very good.
It's 2 pages. We have it here. I know you're supporting this bill. If you wanted to highlight or summarize,
I think the highlights would have to do with the authority of the local education agency. In this case, the LEA. In this case, that there's a lack of clarity in the law. The current law calls for annual audits. Those are generally procedural and don't fully address discretionary expenditures, hiring practices, contracting approaches, just outline the article and what is here. We submitted a request for an audit with the Department of Education regarding the Charter Alliance and its history of expenditures over the prior 3 years. And we understand at this point that they've acknowledged and they're proceeding with that. They're active in that investigation. Our request there was to determine whether there had been any inappropriate expenditure of funds within the Charter Alliance. The other was to seek clarification through written opinion of the Department of Ed and the Secretary of State. And then I do want to go over what Mr. Naso also wanted to make sure you heard today. We would hope, however, that this bill or others like it would go further in clearly enunciating the following authorities or requirements for the sponsoring LEA. The authority to employ at cost to the charter school the auditing firm which conducts the required annual audit. That the idea behind that is that that auditing firm then is the responsibility of the sponsoring district. The authority to require the charter schools submit at a minimum quarterly financial statements approved and signed off by the charter board, making sure that the board is aware of what's going on. And number 3, the authority to require that the charter school use the accounting system and controls used by the sponsoring LEA so that there's a connecting of processes there. So finally, Mr. Naso's closing point. 10 years after this charter law was put into place, we've had successes and failures of charter schools. Considerable money is being redistributed. Virtual school programs using the charter laws to establish lucrative but largely untested businesses. We believe that the legislature needs to take a step back and examine what the original charter school legislation was intended to accomplish, what it has actually accomplished, and what it should attempt to accomplish in the future. This will not be accomplished by dealing with a constant flow of amendments that have occurred in previous sessions and continue into this session. I think that was the key point he wanted to make with you today, along with support of the bill. So thank you for your consideration of this testimony.
Thank you.
He'll be happy to meet or talk over his concerns
questions?
Thank you for your time.
Over our panel.
Senator Walker, what do you think in to the recommendation of kind of a big look?
Mr. Chair, I think that is appropriate. I don't want to wait on the financial management, however, to do the big look, but I think it is time for Oregon to do that. That'd be a nice little interim project, and I emphasize the word little. our interim project, as you know, last interim was dealing with all the educator sex abuse bills, and that took up a lot of time, and I do think it's probably time for the legislature to examine our 10-year-old law. While this bill may seem like it's a small little amendment, I think it's important. And one of the important pieces that was indicated here in point number 3, the authority to require the charter school use the accounting system and controls used by the sponsoring LEA, well, a uniform budget and accounting system is critical. As you know, this session I serve on full Ways and Means, and I'm on all these budget committees. I have to tell you, I've never seen anything like this. We have agency after agency come in, and their budget presentations are all different. Every single one of them are all different. And so it takes you a while to orient yourself to the budget presentation because it's different than the last one. And it should be easy. It should be pretty uniform, and I should be able to go to tab A in this notebook and know it's the same as tab A in the next agency's notebook. And this is what I'm getting at in terms of I think we need some strict controls about following the money. You know, charter schools don't, they only get, what, 95% of the money, but it's 95% of taxpayer money, and I think we ought to be following it, and the rest of it stays with the sponsoring school district. I think it's important in this day of accountability, and I appreciate Senator Morris's concern about getting training for school board members, just not in financial management matters, but in other matters, like how to know what your role is as a school board member as opposed to being a superintendent. They are different roles. And so I think that's important as well. And I'd like to take some of these recommendations and draft them as amendments into this bill if you're interested in moving it forward.
Okay. Senator Morris.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Senator Walker. The question I would have, and it may not be known to you, Senator, but possibly to
Mr. Crum.
Okay, thank you. I lost that, your name, and I apologize for that. But what is the standard practice for reporting accounting to school boards? Do they receive a monthly? Do they receive a quarterly?
At this point, there's the annual audit that's done at the charter level and turned in, and there's other people in the room that could probably talk to that better than I can, but I understand it to be, at this point, an annual audit.
I'm speaking to a normal school board.
Oh.
What's the common practice?
For school boards as opposed to charters?
Right.
Okay. In our school district, it's a monthly check-in and a quarterly full update that they get from our financial folks on the state of matters.
Well, it would seem to me, Mr. Chair, that the same procedures and standards that are used in common to your quote-unquote normal school boards should be common and standard practice for charter boards, mm-hmm. charter school boards as well. With respect to the issue in terms of accounting system and controls, I would suggest that we're not meaning hardware and packages, but we're meaning accounting, mm-hmm. Charts of accounts and practices, mm-hmm. so that you have consistent formats.
Yes.
I assume that's what the recommendation would be.
Yeah. Yes, Mr. Chair, and Senator Morris, that's exactly what I mean, so that you can follow the money. I mean, a charter school is a business. It really is. And so you wouldn't set up a business without having a standard set of chart of accounts and business statements and how you're going to achieve your goal with the money that you have, and requiring them to provide that kind of information, that this is how we're going to set it up beforehand, would give you assurances that there are financial management systems in place. And then when the audit comes in at the end of the year, and it's too bad we don't have a check-in before that, but when the audit comes in, they can compare it to the financial management record that was put in place when it was established and see if they met their goal. And somehow somebody has to be accountable for the money. Now, the charter school board is accountable for the money they get, but where is the taxpayer accountable for the money that went out and went to the charter school?
Thank you both.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Lord here. Karen Hagis. And I have Thomas Sullivan. Did you want to accompany her? We'll come up afterward. Do you want to come up at the same time?
Good afternoon, Chair Haas, members of the committee. My name is Karen Hikas, and I am the director of the Northwest Center for Educational Options, which is the charter school organization here in Oregon. We represent most of the charter schools in the state. We provide technical assistance and advocacy. And I'm here to testify on Senate Bill 375 and ask you to not support it. And it's not because we don't want sound financial management in charter schools, because we are committed to high-quality public charter schools, and we are absolutely convinced that the quality has to be academic, financial, and operational. The reason we're asking you to oppose the bill, and the reason I oppose the bill, and we oppose the bill, is because we believe sound financial management systems are already in place in charter schools. So I wanted to talk to you about the current statutes, rules, and practices that are already in place that we believe constitute sound financial management systems. First of all, charter schools have annual municipal audits, just like every school district, city, county, and other municipalities, which are significantly larger than most of our teeny tiny charter schools. The average size is 157 kids. The municipal audit law that charters are complying with is in my handout. They do that every single year. Another handout is a four-page list of all the information that the auditors ask to look at and do look at in their municipal audits. This is from one charter school, but I know the standards are common across the state. Additionally, every charter school that I'm aware of uses GAAP, Generally Accepted Accounting Principles, which I've also included in this handout. In addition to that, there's a list here of a number of other financial management pieces that charters have in place. Every charter school provides regular financial reports, profit and loss statements, et cetera, to their districts either on a monthly basis or a quarterly basis. That would be the longest amount of time in between reports would be quarterly. Charter schools, you know, receive about half of the per pupil money that traditional district kids receive, and they can't really afford to hire business managers. I know very few charter schools that have business managers, but most of them do contract with CPAs or bookkeepers and so forth. Some other things that are in place, financial management policies, charter schools, kind of at a number of key points, have to demonstrate financial stability, which isn't just making sure that they have a zero sum budget, but it's the protocols, the policies. There are a lot of ingredients that go into financial stability, and they have to demonstrate that before they get sponsored, upon renewal, and all the way through. My primary concern is that this bill isn't going to improve the financial management of charter schools. It doesn't define sound. It doesn't define financial management systems. I think if we wanted to define them, maybe we could codify, require charter schools to use GAAP, require charter schools to use the school district accounting systems, the same codes, cost centers, et cetera. We would be totally open to that. We are not aware of any problems that this bill would address. We know of one charter school whose contracted bookkeeper did abscond with some money, but I know a school superintendent or former school superintendent who absconded with a lot more than that, and an employee of the State Department of Education, former employee, that absconded with a lot of money as well. And we know that districts and ODE have sound financial management practices and systems in place, so I don't know that the systems will always prevent the people who are determined to embezzle money. So again, we would ask that we not support this bill. We would be happy to work together to, you know, systematize and maybe require some of the things that charter schools are already doing, but we think the laws and the practices in place already assure stable financial management. Thank you very much for your consideration.
Thank you. It does, if I could read between the lines, say that you're open to something that does something more about oversight.
Well, I think the districts already have the latitude to do anything they want to do as far as oversight. The contract negotiation that happens is kind of a misnomer. It's really not much of a negotiation. I think that districts already have the latitude and the responsibility to require anything they think is necessary for sound financial oversight, fiduciary responsibility.
Well, I hate to do this to you, but you're okay. That news article that we had, you were quoted as saying that the law, the original law, is pretty skimpy on the question of oversight.
I think, I talked to that reporter for many, many hours.
That's,
you know how that goes.
That's the thing he chose to print, yes.
You
know how that goes.
Some mere piece of one sentence. But I do think the law is not heavy on that, but I think that's okay because I think it gives the districts the latitude that they need. And I think that article is written about schools that had clean audits and had no problems. So I was a little puzzled by that. But I think that there are others who can speak to that. But yes, I said that in the midst of, you know, lots of other things.
Other questions for Senator Morris?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And thank you for your testimony. Your paragraph 4, where you say the survey has identified financial practices.
Mm-hmm.
What would I gather from that with respect to how universally these practices are used? I mean, is this standardized with all of the charter schools, some, a few?
Well, I only put down the ones that, you know, we had answers from a majority of the charter folks on these items. I don't know of any charter school that gives their district quarterly financial reports any less regularly than quarterly. Mostly it's monthly, especially initially, the first year or two. A lot of districts are more comfortable looking at them monthly, and then as they get stabilized, they might just want to see them quarterly. I don't know of any charter schools that wait a year to give a financial report to a district.
Okay, Mr. Sullivan.
Thank you. Mr. Chair and committee members, my name is Thomas Sullivan, and I'm an attorney, and I represented the Clackamas Charter Alliance, originally incorporated as New Urban High School. And I was a little hesitant to come up here because I was asked at the last minute. I came completely unprepared, so you're getting this off the top of my head. And the only thing I wanted to speak to was this article. And I did respond to the author who wrote this article and expressed my great displeasure with it and actually accused her of what I considered violating the most minimal standards of ethics and journalism and irresponsibility in writing an article. And not only that, naivete. And if you look at the article, I think you'd find that really the only story that this journalist had was that Mr. Naso didn't really know what was going on with the charter school that he'd been sponsoring for 7 years, even though they'd been audited every year, even though he had an assistant superintendent who was in charge of this charter schools and worked with them closely day to day. And instead of reporting that, she decided it was more interesting to report insinuation and make it look like there's all sorts of terrible things going on. And in reality, there was nothing to anything in that article. And if I had more time, I could have gone over each of the comments in there specifically.
You can just focus on the bill then.
Okay. Well, that's all I had to say was that this article and it's just amazing the impact that this article has had right from the day it started, and it's just totally an unethical thing to write, I think. It doesn't say anything at all. We don't know whether it was good or whether it was bad. Well, you know, what's that? Sorry. That's pretty much all I had to say.
Okay.
Any questions?
Any questions? No. Thank you for coming.
Appreciate thank you.
That. Were you signed up on the...
No, I just got here. I had come up from Ashland.
And did you want to speak on Senate Bill 375? Why don't you start off with your name?
My name is Michael Warner. I'm the co-director of Armadillo Technical Institute in Phoenix, Oregon. We were one of the first schools chartered under the current Oregon law. I'm the past president of the Oregon Association of Alternatives in Education. I served on the ODE Task Force for Charter Schools. Anyway, it's not that the law is skimpy. The law is very specific. It says we have to have municipal audits. So you have, Karen handed out, this is the 44 items we have to prepare every year for our auditor. We spend approximately between staff time and money about 5 to 7% of our budget on getting ready for that audit. We will start getting ready for our audit every year in July, or in June and early July. The audit isn't going to be done until the end of October. We have to, I have personally worked with two charter schools who were rejected by a school district because their budget process, the budget that they put forth wasn't in the proper format. We already have to use the state codes. Wasn't reasonable in terms of what they were asking for. The state suggested they come and talk to me. I worked with them, and one of those charters was approved based on those issues. Most of the issues facing charter schools and what makes them feasible or unfeasible just has to do with the inequity in funding. But aside from that, we have to provide to our district, and there's nothing in the law that prevents a district from doing this, nor are you going to be able to tabulate enough things in the law to make sure that every district does. We have to provide a monthly budget report every month. We do 3 budget revisions during the year. We have to provide those to the district. We have to provide minutes from our board meetings to the district. We have to open our records and keep our records open to anything that they want to see. They can request to see any document that they want to see that they have a question about in any line item in the budget. And districts have the right to ask for that, and they're going to ask for it because we're not going to get sued for mismanagement of funds. The districts are going to get sued for mismanagement of funds. They already have a vested interest in making sure that charter schools implement their funding adequately. This is a solution in search of a problem, and it's going to set you up for a lawsuit down the road, because I absolutely guarantee you if my district comes and tells me after I've had a successful audit every year for the last 10 or 12 or 14 years that they're going to cancel my charter because they don't like my fiscal management, we're going to court. And that's where this will wind up. It solves no problems. It creates problems. And the requirements of municipal audits more than take care of it. Every change we've made, and we've had to make changes every single year in the way we manage our money. The people who write the checks can't sign the checks. The people who write and sign the checks can't mail the checks. We have 5 different, the person who checks our, balances our checking account can have nothing to do with the writing, signing, or mailing of checks. All of that came from our auditors. It didn't come from the school district. And they go through the level at which, and we spend almost $8,000 a year just on the audit. That's not counting getting ready for the audit. Almost no one can, without having access to a CPA, who knows something about municipal audits, can get ready for the audit. After about 2 or 3 years, when we got past about 25 or 30 students, our auditors said, you need to get a CPA in. So we have one. That's already being done. And, it is stringent and strict and difficult and stressful. Anything you put in the law is not going to make it any more accurate. And there's nothing in the law now to keep it from being as accurate. Thank you.
Questions?
Thank you.
Thank you.
close the hearing on Senate Bill 375 and open the hearing on House Bill 2061.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2061 would give students who aren't ready to graduate with their class this year, who have small deficiencies, basically an additional year before they have to graduate and not be held to the higher credit graduation requirements.
Okay. We have Morgan Allen from Oregon Department of Education.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, Morgan Allen with the Department of Education, here in support of House Bill 2061, which also has the support of the other education groups like COSA and OSBA. But essentially what we have here is a little bit of a quirk. If you remember back to the 2005 legislative session when the legislature passed a bill that moved the minimum number of credits required for graduation from 22 to 24 and added the math and English language arts credit, it said that that would go in effect on July 1st, 2009 of this year. So this school year's freshman class is the first year that's sort of subject to the new diploma requirements that have been put together by the legislature, and then the state board has sort of put in, you know, what the meat of those 24 credits mean. So what we have is an interesting quirk in statute. So let's say you're a senior in high school this year, and you're one or two credits short of graduating. If you don't complete those credits by July 1st, 2009, you would be subject to the new graduation requirements. So when you entered high school, there was one set of standards that said you had to have a minimum of 22 credits, and during your time in school, the legislature and state board have changed that. But you entered under one set of requirements. If for some reason you're a credit too short, and you don't get that by July 1st, 2009, then you'd be subject to the new diploma requirements in order to get your high school diploma. So what this bill really does, it gives a one-year window to students who entered high school as freshmen 4 years ago, a one-year extension, if you will, to complete any credits they are short before they would be subject to the new diploma requirements. And I think everybody feels like that's just a fairness issue. You entered high school 4 years ago under one set of circumstances. You have the opportunity to graduate under those set of circumstances. And without that, what we may have happen is some of those students who are, you know, on the borderline, marginal students who, with a little extra push from that teacher or principal or someone who cares about them, might just be a credit or two short of graduation. And it would be a shame if, you know, they found themselves a credit or two short without this change. Now they'll find themselves an additional two credits short, and they'll have the wrong kind of credits. So it is really a technical fix. It won't occur again in the future because the diploma requirements that kick in 2012 and 2014 are set by administrative rules. So if this type of issue comes up again, the State Board of Education can just modify those rules. So this is the one time we need to fix it by statute. So with that, I would be happy to answer any questions.
For those students, this is basically changing the rules of the game.
That is correct.
Middle of the game.
Yeah. And, Mr. Chair, Morgan answered my question, because we're going to see the graduation requirements move over time. And I just said, I was wondering, are we going to have to continue to do this? But if it's by rule, then it will be okay, just so we don't catch people in the catch-22
right.
In the future.
Okay. And I've had some discussions, I've had some emails on this and discussions with Morgan and the superintendent on this issue. Questions?
Question,
Senator Bonamici.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Morgan, do you have any idea how many students this is affecting?
Senator Haas and Senator Bonamici, we don't. I would suspect it's probably, you know, in the hundreds would be, you know, an educated guess. I mean, the types of kids that we're trying to help here are not someone who's, you know, dropped out 2 or 3 years before graduation or is 10 credits behind, but really borderline students. Maybe for some reason, you know, one semester while they were in school, they had to leave school to work to help out their family. Maybe they had an illness that put them a credit or two behind. Those are a couple of the more common things you hear about why people come up short on credits. And for those students who really are going to go that extra mile and take a summer school course or take a remedial course at the community college, or their school district will let them come back and take that English credit that they may not have gotten, this would remove barriers for them to be able to do that.
Thank you.
Do we have anyone else signed up to testify on this bill, 2061? no one opposed anyway. I think then, Senator Morris?
You want to go into work session?
Yeah. Let's close the hearing on House Bill 2061. I thought you had a question. And I'll open a work session on House Bill 2061.
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 2061 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Morris moves House Bill 2061 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion? Seeing none, any objections? Seeing none, the motion passes with a due pass recommendation to the floor. And I'll close the work session on House Bill 2061.
Would you like to assign a carrier, Mr. Chair?
I think it's my turn, and I'll carry it.
Okay, don't.
I'd like to open a work session on Senate Bill 512.
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, Senate Bill 512 is a bill we've had before the committee before as the follow-up to Senate Bill 1092 from the 2008 session. We do have amendments before us today, and I could go through them, or folks that have been involved in the drafting and formulation of them could go through them. Yes.
I think I would like to get some clarification or maybe a summary on the dash fives and the dash sixes.
The dash fives were brought forward as friendly amendments from the Department of Education, essentially to ensure that the Oregon School for the Deaf, Oregon School for the Blind, and the Youth Corrections Authorities, youths that would trigger notification, our folks in those schools receive notification and their mechanisms to receive notification. In addition, there's an attempt to make it clear which school districts fall under these. The previous definition in the bill would have included ESDs in the school district definition. So this definition, both the statutes referenced are in your packets to make it clear kind of the differences between the two. But the school districts in the dash fives are basically what you think of as school districts, your union high schools and common school districts. It also specifies locations where youth violations would be subject to the notice provisions. So, and we wouldn't hurt to just hear a little bit more because there are some questions and concerns about exactly what that applies to, and also provides an operative date of July 1st, 2009. The E-clause would still be there, but the operative date would be this summer at the end of the academic year.
Okay.
Dash sixes, Mr. Chair?
Yes.
They do add back in the sexual assault of an animal or animal abuse to in any degree that would trigger notice. There are a couple other things: that manufacture of a controlled substance, delivery of a controlled substance, or delivery of a controlled substance to a person under 18 years of age would trigger notice. And there's a provision specific to assault in the fourth degree. That's the statute that's referenced there at the bottom of the dash sixes. In those cases, the folks that are responsible for providing notice would go to the court and ask whether or not for assault force notice should go to the school districts and students and staff.
Okay.
And then the folks who've been more involved will come up and tell you where I wasn't quite on, or hopefully I was.
All right. And the fives and sixes take care of all the previous amendments.
The other set that's before you are the dash twos, and those were put forward as a minority report to the Oregon Law Commission, and those really do stand alone and are separate from the fives and sixes.
All right. Well, speaking of minority reports, then let's have John DiLorenzo come up and Lori Wimmer come up. If you could just comment on the fives and sixes, and your take. And Maura is here. Yes.
Why don't you comment first?
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair and committee members. For your record, Lori Wimmer, representing the Oregon Education Association. And we're here today to offer the Dash 6 amendments as consensus amendments between the Oregon Education Association and our friends who were originally on the other side of some of our concerns. We met and were able to come to a resolution. I think your committee chair, administrator did a fine job of describing what was done. We had consensus on the restoration of the animal abuse provisions. We removed alcohol from the list of alcohol and drug crimes to receive notice and just focused on the most serious controlled substance related crimes with minors in connection with a violent act or manufacture. And then finally, with respect to the final piece, where an offense would come out of the bill under 512, come out of the law, such as the assault fours. We just wanted to make sure that given that school people aren't in those juvenile proceedings, that there would be somebody in statute tasked with the job of making sure that if in a particular given case, and in the assault four case, it would make sense to notice the school, that this would be a potential to opt in, that the juvenile authority or DA would advise the court that opting it in would be a good idea in that particular case. That way it's not pulling all the assault fours back in, it's just doing it on a case-by-case basis, but with somebody explicitly designated to do it. And with that, we were comfortable. If you should adopt the dash sixes, we would be comfortable with the bill. We also support the department's dash fives as technical clarifications.
Chair Hass, members of the committee, Maura Roach for Juvenile Rights Project. I think Lori covered it. We're comfortable with the dash sixes, and we don't see any problems with the dash fives.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm John DiLorenzo. I'm a member of the Oregon Law Commission and was the author of the minority report. I have reviewed the dash sixes with the loose confederation of advisors that my minority report has attracted, and the dash sixes are satisfactory to us.
Very good. I very much thank you for the lambs lying down with the lions, or however you want to put it, in coming together. It makes our job easier. And given the animal abuse phrase, I probably shouldn't have used that. Any questions of these three?
Sorry, just tell Doug Nilo that minority reports never pass. So
there you go.
I would, committee, like to adopt these amendments today, if we could, if you're so inclined, and the only reason we couldn't move it today is because we lack the appropriate paperwork from the fiscal office. But I would like to adopt these, Senator Morris, if you want to get us going.
Are we in a work session?
We are in a work
session.
Okay,
thank you. Mr. Chair, I move to adopt the Dash 5 amendments to Senate Bill 512.
Senator Morris moves to adopt the Dash 5 amendments to Senate Bill 512. Discussion? Seeing none, any objections? So ordered.
Mr. Chair, I move to adopt the Dash 6 amendments to Senate Bill 512.
Senator Morris moves to adopt the Dash 6 amendments to Senate Bill 512. Discussion? Seeing none, so adopted. Thank you.
Thank you.
I'll close the work session to Senate Bill 512. And I will open a work session on Senate Bill 442.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, we've had this bill in front of us a couple times before. It has to do with higher ed consolidation. At our last hearing, the committee did adopt the Dash 2 amendments, which you still have before you. But you also have Dash 4 amendments before you that obviously you've been closely involved with, Mr. Chair. I'm happy to go through them or have the Chancellor go through them, whatever you'd like.
Well, what I'd like is if we could bring the Chancellor and the Commissioner of Community Colleges up, and perhaps you could walk us through here.
Yeah, the Dash 4s would replace the measure, but for the emergency clause. They do insert goal statements to make it clear what the committee is trying to do with these changes. It authorizes the joint board, so you'd be getting your K-12 community college and higher education sectors, primarily community college and higher education sectors, to look at converting to the semester calendar, specifically thinking about and looking at increasing student enrollment and success for role students, as well as combining enrollment management functions for...
Hold on. We're on the... These are the Dash 4s. There's a flurry of paper around it.
Sorry.
You have all of these.
Mm-hmm.
For regional institutions, looking at combining enrollment management functions and specifically determine the financial viability of the OSU Cascades campus in Bend. The board would also be asked to develop and implement a common admissions process, universal document imaging, electronic storage of documents, and again for the regionals, a standardized, integrated, and common university management and student services software program. Lastly, it would establish the Oregon University Efficiency Savings Fund, with the idea being that efficiencies that are identified would accrue to each institution's use for tuition reduction and student services.
Okay, and committee, as we've discussed before, and but is now, I think, clarified in this bill, there's goals at the beginning and I think a section at the end that I think clarify the process or where we're trying to go, which is to strengthen the system by keeping the money, if there are any savings, in the system and by setting out the goals. So, Chancellor, you want to give us your take on this? And many thanks for your help and with this in between times.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. For the record, George Pernsteiner, Chancellor of the Oregon University System. And I want to thank Senator Haas and Committee Administrator Richardson for all their hard work on this bill. The important thing to note for me is why we're doing this, and that's in the recitals in the beginning, and Senator Haas mentioned that. We are looking for cost savings in order to hold down the cost of education, to strengthen the universities, to maximize the opportunity for Oregonians, and to maintain the quality of the programs of our institutions. And that's the framework within which we are addressing each of these items that are in the bill, in particular those in the Dash 4. The Dash 4 amendments provide us with some important opportunities to work with the community colleges in studying the opportunities for semester conversion, either on a statewide basis or on a regional basis, to look also, and I think this is in Section 1 sub 2, at success for rural residents, success that may require us to look at structural, legal, or funding changes in the way that we serve those residents in the state. Those are the things that we would do jointly with the community colleges as part of the joint board's effort. In addition, we would be looking and bringing back to you a discussion of the missions and the programs of each of our campuses in order to show that we are eliminating unnecessary duplication, focusing on making sure that we don't have a lot of low enrollment programs, and focusing on student success. There would also be some important changes that we would be considering and in some cases making. The first is the common admissions. As I mentioned last time, we are in the process of actually implementing that. This afternoon I approved funding for the programming changes that would be necessary to implement that system so that for the fall of 2010 we in fact will have that. We will also be looking at sharing systems for the campuses of fewer than 7,500 FTE. That will first have to be assessed in terms of cost-benefit, but if it is cost-beneficial, we will of course be seeking the ability to move forward on that. The entire purpose of all of this is we recognize that we will have to reduce cost in this environment, but we want to do it in a way that does not harm quality and that maximizes opportunity for Oregonians. And I thank the chair and the committee administrator for helping us see our way to some language that I think will help us do that. So we support the Dash 4 amendments.
Good afternoon. For the record, I'm Cam Preuss. I am the Commissioner of Community Colleges, the Department of the Director of the Department of Community Colleges and Workforce Development. We too support the Dash 4 amendments and have been in conversation with others in the community college community about semester conversion and other ways in which we can reduce costs, but we won't know if that reduces costs until we study. So we're on board for that. And the second item that's particular to community college here around success for students in the rural parts of the state, I think it's important to note that both the State Board of Higher Education and the Department of Community Colleges and Workforce Development did studies over the last interim about student success, very specific to each of our populations around student success. And both of our work was about rural, but we didn't do it together. And we certainly shared notes and went back and forth, but I think there's definitely some benefit to be gained by continuing and really concentrating on the rural student and the success of the rural student. So again, are in support of the Dash Force. Thank you.
Questions?
Yeah, Mr. Chair, not so much a question. I guess I would just suggest that the look at moving to a semester system shouldn't be driven just by dollars, but by seamlessness as well.
And some of the goal here is not just, you know, it's not cost savings, but to make the system better, raise the quality.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I would just follow up, Senator Cruz. The semester system discussion needs to focus on what it does to the academic learning process, because terms are not nearly as effective, in my judgment, as a semester system. But, Mr. Chair, and I don't know who to direct this question to, but I'm curious
how
this university efficiency savings fund would work. If you achieve savings, how do those savings actually get into a fund? And then how do we prohibit the notwithstanding that we're very famous for in the way that we treat higher ed? And that's just kind of an editorial comment rather than a question.
Okay. Well, we did have legislative council go through a couple iterations until they landed on this particular scheme, if you will, to use this, and it only goes forward one biennium because of the requirement of not binding future legislatures. So there's that, and they worked out the credit system, I think, pretty good. I mean, we've had this looked at in different ways, and I think they came to a reasonable explanation of crediting and savings.
Mr. Chair, it's my understanding after talking with the committee administrator, so I'm going to give you my interpretation. Let's see if this works. We, each biennium, will identify the estimated savings from the work that has been done. We will then take those dollars, put them in an account. That account will then carry over and be credited back to the campuses where the money was saved. And I think that's the way this reads. That was my understanding of it and the way I'm now reading it.
Dana, did you want to?
No, Mr. Chair. I think that's what we've got at this point.
Senator Morris?
Well, yeah, thank you. It's great policy if we keep our end of the bargain.
Yeah, if we don't, okay. If we keep our hands off of it.
If we keep our end of the bargain, it's good policy. But, and there's no way that you can put that in a statute, unfortunately. But.
Right. Good point.
Senator Bonamici.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I want to thank the chair and everyone who worked so hard to come up with this. And I'm encouraged, and I think it's good policy. I wanted to ask about something I asked about before, which is the common application process. And there's something on page 6 of the Dash 4 that talks about a common applications process that permits applicants to be considered for admission to more than one institution. And what I want to do is make sure that at least there's consideration of the common application, the nationally recognized common application, because as I've mentioned to the committee, I have a daughter who just went through the college applications process, and the common application seems to be the trend for students who are applying to multiple institutions, and it's a nationally recognized, I think there's 300 and some institutions that are using it now, and so I don't want anything in this to inhibit your ability to consider the use of the common application, because I think it will be beneficial in the long run for that common application, and it does allow for supplements per individual schools if you want to add, I think you do need to add a specific supplement for each institution, but I just want to make sure that we're not doing anything that prohibits you from considering or using the common application.
Okay. If there are no further questions, I want to say thank you to the Chancellor and the Commissioner for, I think, going a little bit out of their comfort zone on this, and I appreciate that, and I very much appreciate the help of the presidents that are in the room here, too. I think they may have gone a little bit out of their comfort zone as this is proceeding. Senators, if we could do the same as we did in the bill before, which is to adopt the amendments and wait for fiscal report paperwork before we move the bill, I appreciate that.
I have a question. Is it a procedural question, Mr. Chair? Because we've already adopted the dash twos, do the dash fours replace the dash twos, or do we need to unadopt the dash twos?
They replace.
Okay, thank you.
Okay, Senator Morris.
Yeah. Mr. Chair, I move we reconsider the vote by which the dash two amendments dated March 4, 2009 were adopted.
Senator Morris moves to reconsider the vote by which the committee adopted the dash two amendments dated March 4, 2009. I think this is your question, Senator Bonamici. Any discussion? Seeing none. Any objection? If not, the motion carries, and the measure is once again before the committee in its original form.
Mr. Chair, I move to adopt the Dash 4 amendments to Senate Bill 442.
Senator Morris moves to adopt the Dash 4 amendments to Senate Bill 442. Any discussion? Seeing none. Is there objection? Seeing none. If not, the amendments are adopted. And we'll try to move this next week.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Cruz.
I want to thank you for your work on this thing. It's a good piece of work.
Thank you. Appreciate that. We will close the work session on Senate Bill 442 and need unanimous consent to allow Senator Metzger to vote on House Bill 2061.
I don't think so.
Does he have a good excuse, Mr. Chair?
Pardon me?
Does he have a good excuse, Mr. Chair?
I think he's barely trying not to spread my germs to you was my excuse. You need a gavel on that.
Unanimous
consent. No objection. Senator Morris. Senator Metzger, how do you vote on Senate Bill 2061? He votes aye.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Any other business before our committee? Seeing none, we are adjourned.
I hope you feel better.
I knew we were going to be that fast. I would